Welcome. This is another in a series of interpreter roundtables. My name is Martin Tanner. I'm your host today. This is lesson 23 from the LDS Gospel Doctrine Manual and covers 1 Samuel chapters 18 through 24. This is right after David has killed Goliath. And actually, it ends with the completion of 1 Samuel, although the lesson doesn't specifically focus on this point. It goes through the death of Saul. The basic overview of the lesson today is the first part of 1 Samuel 18, specifically verses 1 through 16, where Jonathan and David make a covenant of friendship. And this is a close friendship and a wonderful friendship. And after that, we have towards the end of chapter 18 and in the beginning of chapter 19, David fighting the Philistines in exchange for the right to marry Saul's daughter. And from there, in chapter 20, we have David and Jonathan renewing their friendship and having this covenant continue not just between themselves, but between their households. In chapters 23 and 24, David has the ability to take the life of Saul when they, unbeknownst to Saul anyway, encounter each other in a cave, and yet David does not take Saul's life. The stated objective of the lesson, the purpose of the lesson, is to encourage members to be true to their friends, as Jonathan and David were true to each other, and to avoid being consumed by jealousy and hatred, as Saul was towards David. One of the other important underlying purposes of this lesson, which is not stated in the manual, but which would have been very, very important to the early Israelites, was to provide a basis for the understanding of why David came to be king. And the gist of that understanding was that Saul fell from grace because of his character flaws, because of his jealousy, because of his pride. And we see that even though there would have been many times justification for David to retaliate against Saul, he does not do that. And so these last chapters of Samuel show David's great character and his goodness in the face of adversity, returning good for evil, and showing by that that he was chosen by God to be the next king of Israel. So those are some of the underlying themes of this fascinating book. It should also be important to note by way of background that 1 Samuel, according to almost every biblical scholar that has looked at it, is a composite of a number of different sources. We have the Septuagint, which is the earliest Greek version of the Bible. There are a number of early Hebrew manuscripts, and all of these have slightly varying readings, and some of them are quite significant. One of those we'll touch on as we get into the actual background of this particular section. In chapter 18 proper, as we start our lesson, Saul and David finish a conversation, and after that, Saul's son Jonathan is very impressed by David. And from that time forward, it says that Jonathan swore an eternal friendship with David, and that was reciprocal. And in verse 4, it says that Jonathan took off the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his armor and sword, his bow, and his belt. These were all signs of great honor and affection that Jonathan had towards David. It shows how loyal he was going to be, how impressed he was with David and David's character. And shortly after that, we have this scene that begins in verse 6 of chapter 18 of David returning after killing Goliath. They come home from the war. And the women, it says, came out from every town, and they met King Saul. And they were singing joyful songs. They were dancing. They were playing tambourines and lyres, which is a small harp-like instrument. And in their celebration, they sang a song, which is sort of quoted as saying that Saul killed thousands, but David killed tens of thousands. Now, in the Septuagint, it doesn't have King Saul present. It says that as David was returning from the war, the women came out and met David and sang this song, which would make a lot more sense. It would be a little bit difficult to conceive of people being so callous towards their king that they would come out and sing a song directly to the king that would be an affront to him. Well, you killed thousands, but hey, David killed tens of thousands. That's probably not something that was said directly to King Saul's face. And yet that's what many of the readings of the early manuscripts do say. Scholars tend to believe that what really was going on here is that there were several early manuscripts. Some of them said that as David was returning, this is what happened. Others said that as Saul came back, this is what happened. And so there's sort of a conglomerate that happens here. But whatever the underlying facts were, we know that the songs that were sung by the women made King Saul feel jealous and angry. And this is the great character flaw that is Saul's undoing. His jealousy of David and how others saw David as greater than he was. This was something that Saul could not bear. And it's a sad thing. It's a character trait that we see in many people throughout the world and throughout different families, where someone is jealous of the success or the good fortune of others. The different characteristics that are describing that kind of behavior go from pride to jealousy to anger. And those are all things to, of course, be avoided. And that is the main point of the lesson. In verse 10 of chapter 18, it says that the next day, an evil spirit from God took control of Saul. And as David was playing his harp, which he did every day, that Saul threw a spear at him twice. But each time, David was able to dodge it, and it missed the mark. Now, the Joseph Smith translation changes it a little bit and makes it clear that it wasn't God that took control of Saul and turned him into a jealous, evil person at this point. It does talk about an evil spirit, but it doesn't have it as coming from God. The gist of the difference between the Joseph Smith translation and the King James Version here then is that of free agency. And the free agency that Saul exercised here was absolute. God did not cause Saul to make bad choices. Saul made those of his own free will. The sad part about this was that it says in verse 12 that Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had abandoned him. That statement sort of summarizes the entire gist of the lesson here. We learn that God is with David, and Saul knows it, and Saul cannot abide by that. But rather than change and become good, he sinks further and lower, as we will see. Starting in verse 17 of chapter 18, we have a series of statements which show that Saul reneges on the promise that he gives, that whoever defeats Goliath will marry his oldest daughter, Merib. And although she has been promised to David, she is given to another man in verse 19 named Adriel. And then we learn that in verse 20, Saul's daughter, Michal, there are several different pronunciations for it, but that's sort of the traditional English version. Saul's daughter, Michal, fell in love with David. And when Saul heard of this, he was pleased, but not for the right reason, because he said to himself in verse 21 that he will give his daughter Michal to David and use her to trap David so that he will be killed by the Philistines. And so Saul's even manipulating his own daughter to try to kill David. David's response is good and true. In verse 24, the officials tell Saul what David has said, which was that it's a great honor to be the king's son-in-law. And Saul ordered his servants to tell David in response that all the king wants from him as payment for his daughter as a bride are the foreskins of 100 dead Philistines as revenge on his enemies. Let's stop and take a look at this. People often gloss over this statement. 100 foreskins. Well, they might gloss over it because of slight embarrassment or because it seems like a strange request. It certainly is something that's out of character for our time, not something that would ever be requested in any context today. But it is something that is reminiscent of other statements in the Bible. And I'll bring up one statement in the Book of Mormon. And that's where, as Ammon slays those who are threatening the flocks of the king, as many of those who advance and try to take away the king's flocks, Ammon cuts off their arms. And if we just left it at that, it wouldn't have any bearing here. But what happens is that the servants of the king gather up the severed arms and take those to the king to show, to prove what has been done. In other words, this is a physical showing based on severed body parts, if we can be so crass and blunt as to describe it that way, which shows this great accomplishment. And that's, in a different context, the same kind of thing that we see here. The king needs some kind of proof. And so what is the request? It's, bring me the foreskins of 100 dead Philistines. And David, in verse 26, is delighted with this, and his men go out in verse 27, and they don't just kill 100, which is the request, they kill 200 Philistines. And they bring back the foreskins to the king. And they are all counted out. And as a result of that, Michal is married to David in verse 27. Saul realizes that the Lord is with David and that his daughter Michal loves him. So in verse 29 of chapter 18, it says that he becomes even more afraid of David and was his enemy as long as he lived. How sad indeed, because this could have been a joyous time for King Saul to have an alliance of marriage with his daughter, and David, but that's not the way that Saul sees it. Chapter 19 begins with the repeated thereafter persecution of David by Saul. Saul tells his son Jonathan and all the officials in his court that he plans to kill David. But because of David's and Jonathan's alliance, the plot is told to David by Jonathan. And he tells in verse 2 of chapter 19, David that he should be careful tomorrow. And because of that, David is spared. One of the great things that we learn about David is that because he does good, good comes to him. If he had not been so close to Jonathan and been such a good person, Jonathan would not have warned him about the plots of his father Saul. But he is willing to do so. And so we see in chapter 19 that the goodness of David is returned to him. In verse 4, Jonathan praises David to Saul, trying to get his father to change his mind about David. And he tells his father, David's never done anything to you. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And he uses all the persuasion that he possibly can, talks about David and Goliath and the great victory. But Saul, in verse 6, it says, Saul was convinced by what Jonathan said and made a vow in the Lord's name that he would not kill David. But then, all too soon, this convincing is overcome by Saul's jealousy and by Saul's anger towards David because the people like him. One of the next things that happens here is another statement in verse 9 that an evil spirit from the Lord took control of Saul as an explanation that he had changed again from liking David to being against him and trying to kill him. Again, the Joseph Smith translation here tells us that the evil spirit was not from God, showing again that we have free agency, that Saul had free agency. The next comment here is very similar to the earlier one. In verse 10 of chapter 19, it says, Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, but David dodged, and the spear struck in the wall, and David ran away and escaped, reminiscent of what had happened not too long earlier in these chapters. That same night, Saul sent some men to watch David's house and kill him the next morning. However, David's wife, Michal, warned him and said that if you don't get away tonight, tomorrow, you will be dead. So she let David down from a window, and he ran away and escaped. And then there's this curious statement, which is quite a frank admission, and one that is no doubt true, because why else would it be here? In verse 13, that says, then Michal, David's wife, took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a pillow made of goat's hair at its head. The gist of the unusual part here, excuse me, is that an idol is in the household. We're not told exactly what kind. This could have been an early Jewish idol. And it might have been some other kind of an idol. Whatever it was, idols were not to be condoned, and yet here it is. After she does that, covers it with some things, Saul's men come to get David, and Michal tells them that he's sick. But Saul sent them back again for David, And they say, this is in verse 15, quote, carry him here in his bed and I will kill him, close quote. So they go inside to try to find David, and they find the idol in the bed instead of Saul, and the goat's hair pillow at his head. And Saul then confronts his daughter, David's wife, Michal, and says, why have you tricked me? Why have you let my enemy escape? This shows exactly what Saul thinks of David, that he is actually an enemy, even though David has never done anything that might lead somebody to believe that he was an enemy. Let's move now to chapter 20. In chapter 20, David flees, and in Ramah he went to Jonathan and asks Jonathan, what have I done? What crime have I committed? What wrong have I done to your father, Saul, to make him want to kill me? This is David's comment to Jonathan. And Jonathan answers, and he said, God forbid that you should die. My father tells me everything he does, important or not, and he would not hide this from me. And then Jonathan says, it just can't be so. But David answers, and he says that he knows that King Saul is trying to kill him. And so from there, we have this back and forth and back and forth about Saul wanting to kill David and how desperate and difficult it is. Verse 5 is interesting because it says, after Jonathan's comment that he would do anything that David asked him to do, the comment is, tomorrow is the new moon festival, David replied, and I am supposed to eat with the king. But if it's all right with you, I'll go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father notices that I'm not at the table, tell him that I begged your permission to hurry home to Bethlehem, since that's the time for the annual sacrifice for my entire family. So here's this reason for David to not be present. He needs to sacrifice for his entire family. But the context here is the New Moon Festival. New Moon Festivals are not something that would sound like they are Jewish and Christian in origin, and yet they certainly were Jewish in origin at the time. There were a number of unusual festivals that might seem a bit out of character for the way we worship today. But it was a way of being thankful to God. Towards the end of chapter 20, we have the aftermath of David's not being present at this new moon festival. And in verse 17, we have this reaffirmation that Jonathan and David have of the closeness of their families, and they reaffirm their promises to each other. One of the other things that we have here is a statement that Saul makes towards the end here. In verse 26, it says that at this festival, David's place was empty, but Saul said nothing that day because he thought something had perhaps happened to him. And maybe he isn't ritually pure. Maybe there was a reason why he wasn't there. And then in verse 27, he says that on the following day, the day after the new moon festival, David's place was still empty. And so Saul asked Jonathan, why didn't David come to the mill either yesterday or today? And Jonathan answers that David had begged him to go to Bethlehem, saying, please let me go because our family is celebrating a sacrificial feast. And so what's the response? Instead of understanding in verse 30, Saul becomes furious. It says furious with Jonathan. And he calls him rebellious and faithless. And he says how rebellious and faithless your mother was, insulting him by reference to his mother. And he also says that he knows now that Jonathan is taking sides with David. And he calls him a disgrace. And then in verse 31, he says, don't you realize that as long as David is alive, you will never be king, trying to drive a wedge between David and Jonathan. And then the final threat, he tells Jonathan, bring David here because he must die. And the response back from Jonathan is, why? What has he ever done? And at that, Saul threw a spear at Jonathan to kill him. And Jonathan realizes that his father is truly determined to kill David and that words are not going to fix the problems that are present. And that is the truth. And this is the underlying point where David goes from bad to even worse. And this is the part of the story that is present to show Saul's decline and David's goodness. At the beginning of chapter 21, David flees to the priest in a place called Nob. And he there has some place that he can stay away from the dangers that are found by being around Saul. And in verse 9, we have this interesting comment. Let's go back to verse 6. The priest gives David the sacrificial bread because the only bread he had were the loaves to be offered to God. This is an interesting verse here because this is the same example that Jesus himself uses. When he and his apostles are hungry and they gather food on the Sabbath, he justifies it the same way that it was justified by David in verse 21 here. His men were hungry. There is a necessity here. This is the ox out of the Meyer kind of exception to the general rule. Certainly, usually, people were not to eat the sacrificial offerings, but if you are hungry and it's expedient, you may do so. David thought so here. Jesus thought so later on by reference to verse 6 of chapter 21 here in 1 Samuel. Then in verse 9 of chapter 21, it says, Ahimelech answered David saying, quote, I have the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in Elah Valley. It is behind the ephod wrapped in a cloth. If you want it, take it. And David says that he wants it. And so David flees King Saul. He has the sword of Goliath, and he uses some interesting tactics to try to stay free of those who are after him. In verse 13 of chapter 21, it talks about him pretending to be insane or acting like a madman so that when people thought about restraining him, they would let him go as being sort of a harmless, insane person. Kind of an interesting tactic that was taken by David, not one that would work in our context or our society today, but one that worked quite well for David. And then we get to chapter 22, which is quite an interesting chapter as well, and only briefly will we cover this. David flees from the city of Gath, and he goes to a cave near the town of Adullam. And when his brothers and the rest of his family hear that he's there, they join him. And people who were oppressed or in debt or dissatisfied go to him. And it talks about 400 people doing that. And he becomes their leader. And from there, David leads quite a sizable group of people who are sort of recluses from society for one reason or another. He stays in the hill country, and he goes back and forth to try to keep himself safe. Excuse me. And then we get to the last two chapters that we'll cover in any length here today. One of those is chapter 23. In chapter 23, David continues to fight the Philistines and to flee Saul. Now, isn't it fascinating that David would do that? David is blessed with continued success on the battlefield, as we see at the beginning of chapter 23. Despite the fact that he's trying to flee for his own life, when the Philistines attack, he defeats them. He saves the town that the Philistines are attacking in chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. And then, interestingly enough, in chapter 23, verse 10, what happens is that when Saul learns that David is in this little town of Keilah, he prepares his armies to destroy the entire city. What changed Saul from a righteous king to someone who was willing to kill an entire city to try to go after David? I suppose only Saul can answer, but it's quite a sad commentary. This reaffirms yet again that Saul has great hatred, great jealousy, and great, great pride. And that brings us to chapter 24. When Saul comes back from fighting the Philistines, he was told that David was in the wilderness, and Saul took 3,000 of his best soldiers and went looking for David and his men. And he went to a place that we could translate as east of the Wild Goat Rocks. Quite a description, an interesting description. Obviously, there are wild goats there, and obviously, very rocky place. And he comes to a cave in verse 3, close to some sheep pens that are by the road. And how else can you say it? He goes into this cave to relieve himself. And it happens to be the very cave in which David and his men are hiding. Now, obviously, David and his men have been in the cave for a long time, so their eyes are adjusted to the relative darkness, and they creep back into the very far back depths of the cave and are very quiet. And as they see Saul come in, David's own men suggest to him that he go and kill Saul so that his problems will be over. But once again, showing his great character, what David does is he creeps up, and he is able to see in the dark Saul's eyes are not yet adjusted to the dark because he has just come in. And David cuts off part of Saul's robe. This would have been the bottom portion of the robe. And he hangs on to it. He thinks about killing Saul, but as he considers the matter, he decides that he will not do anything to Saul. In verse 6, towards the end, he decides that he must not harm him because he is the king chosen by the Lord, showing great loyalty despite the fact that this is a man who has tried to kill him multiple times and he could have easily taken his life. After Saul leaves the cave, in verse 8, David gets up and goes out and calls after Saul and says, holding up this piece of the robe, in verse 11, "Look, I could have killed you. Instead, I only cut off this piece of your robe." And at that, Saul feels bad. And you can see that he goes back and forth and back and forth over time. But we have this interesting final statement of what seems like goodness from Saul, but is in great contrast to the way he has acted. He says in verse 18, "How good you have shown yourself to me to be, because you did not kill me, even though the Lord put me in your power. How often does a man catch an enemy and then let him go unharmed? The Lord bless you for what you have done to me today." And now here's a foreshadowing of the future in verse 20. "Now I'm sure that you will be king of Israel and that the kingdom will continue under your rule. But promise me in the Lord's name that you will spare my descendants so that my name and my family's name will not be completely forgotten." And then David promises that he will do that in verse 22. Then Saul goes back home. And that is the formal end of our lesson, but a few other comments here. Fascinatingly enough, we see some of the last statements of Saul as being quite good and almost repentant. In chapter 25, Samuel dies. And then we have only a few other things that we'll touch on and then we'll end for today. We see that in chapter 28 that Saul backslides again. He seeks first from God to find out what to do in connection with yet another incursion by the Philistines. But God doesn't answer him. He seeks for answers from prophets, and they do not help him. And he seeks for help from his other counselors and those around him, but no help is given. So finally, in chapter 28, in verse 3, we have this series of verses where we learn that Saul decides he's going to consult a medium. And who does he consult? He asks his men, after finding out that the Lord doesn't answer him, the Urim and Thummim doesn't help him, and the prophets don't help him, in verse 6, that he asks for his officials to find him a woman who is a medium. In other words, find me somebody who can consult with the spirits. And they tell him in verse 7 that there's one in Endor, which is a city. And so Saul disguises himself. He can't be seen as king, going to consult a medium in Endor, but since he does not receive an answer from prophets or the Urim and Thummim or from dreams or from the Lord, he goes to Endor. And the result of this is quite an interesting exchange. What happens is that when the medium discovers that this is King Saul before her, she is angry in verse 12 and asks why she has been tricked. And after this, King Saul tells her, "Don't worry, it'll be fine. You will not be harmed. Everything will be all right. Please answer questions." And so here we have Saul consulting with a medium, showing that he has backslid yet once again. And from there, we have a final war between the Philistines and the Israelites. And in chapter 31, we find out what happens to King Saul. It says at the beginning of chapter 31 that the Philistines fight a battle at a place called Mount Gilboa. And the Israelites, many of them were killed there. And King Saul and his sons were wounded. And what happens is that in verse 2 is that the Philistines catch up with them and kill three of King Saul's sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. And so here we have Saul's sons dead. Saul is badly wounded, and he asks his helper, a young boy who carries his weapons, to kill him. And the boy is terrified and will not do that. And so Saul takes his own sword at the end of verse 4, and he throws himself or falls upon his own sword and kills himself. And then the young boy sees that Saul is dead, doesn't want to be captured by the Philistines, and kills himself as well. We learn the sad state of Saul. After he is dead, the Philistines come, and in verse 9, they cut off his head, strip off his armor, and send the good news to everyone around about the demise of King Saul. And with that, we have the position of king of the Israelites clear for David now to become the king. And we also have the sad end of Saul, who was consumed with jealousy. With that, we'll close with the idea that we should always try to overcome pride, jealousy, and anger. We should do good to those who persecute us, to those who do evil to us, and to those who are jealous of us, as David did. And we should not be jealous or angry or prideful, as was Saul. Join us again on another roundtable discussion from the Interpreter. I'm Martin Tanner. Thank you for joining us today.